Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Burton Blatt, the Dean of Education at Syracuse University. Dr. Blatt, there's an emphasis today on moving persons who are mentally retarded out of institutions and into the community to live in neighborhood homes known as community residences. Why this emphasis?
I think essentially, Sue, the institutions have failed. Now, for a long time, we thought that we could reform the institutions, that the failure of the institutions could be laid to the lack of fiscal support. But you know that in the last decade, institutional budgets have gone up enormously. When I first began studying these institutions in a formal manner about 15 years ago, the per capita expenditure for a child or an adult in institutions in the northeastern United States was approximately $6 or $7 or $8 a day per person. Today, there are institutions that expend $100 a day per person. In my recent round of visits to institutions, I found one which expended $60,000 per resident each year. The average institution I saw expends approximately $25,000 or $30,000 per resident a year. And so we've had a decade of exposés, great public outcries against inhuman treatment, enormous expenditures of resources to improve the institutions, and although they are surely better places today as a result of all of that activity, they're still not adequate for human habitation.
Now, what evidence do you think we have that the new emphasis is truly benefiting persons who are retarded?
The evidence is simple if you view the objective of deinstitutionalization to return people to community living. By merely placing people in the community, you've achieved that objective. Now, of course, those programs would have to be associated with proper schooling for children in the community, sheltered activities for adults who are unable to work in competitive industry, vocational opportunities for others, a job placement for others, recreational activities, all of those things would be required for the community placements to be programmatically better. But in the sense that the main purpose of deinstitutionalization is to integrate people, by, quote, merely doing that, you've achieved the goal. Let me go a step further. When the slaves were freed after the Emancipation Proclamation, there were many years, some say 100 years, some say the goals of providing better opportunities for blacks have yet to be achieved. But when the slaves were freed, they were freed. And if the purpose of the Emancipation Proclamation was to free them, that goal was achieved, irrespective of whether the former slaves had better educational opportunities, or better jobs, or better lives. Now, the goal of the deinstitutionalization program is to bring people to the community, and by simply accomplishing that, you've accomplished the major goal.
And what would you say are the benefits to the community of having residences for persons who are retarded?
Well, let's look at that question, but let's first ask what are the benefits to the individual? The benefits to the former slaves is that they gained their freedom, irrespective, again, of whether they found better work or more remuneration for their work. They were now free people. The benefits for the mentally retarded is now they are living in normal communities. So the benefits to the retarded are, at least in my view, very plain, very direct, and certain. They will now be free in the community where once they were segregated in institutions. I truly believe that there will be other benefits. There will be more opportunities for them to work, to engage in a worthwhile recreational pursuit, to have more normal family or family-like lives. I truly believe that, especially if with the deinstitutionalization, those resources that are in the institution are converted to the community. Now, what are the benefits for the rest of us, for the ordinary people of society? There are such as ordinary people. We've become a very segregated culture. Old people are placed more and more in geriatric facilities, convalescent homes. People more and more live in communities segregated by income. I dare say I truly believe that in spite of the tremendous gains made in the human rights movements on behalf of minority groups, people as much as ever live in racially segregated communities here in our country. Somebody once wrote a paper, Richard Hungerford, on how our lives are enriched through the diversity we find in our everyday activities, that there is an enrichment through difference, that we become less fearful, we become more courageous, we understand ourselves as human beings better as we have opportunities to interact with people of different races, different colors, different creeds, different capabilities. You know, Sue, the one fact of our lives that we're most prone to forget, the one we want desperately to forget, it seems, is our own mortality. And it seems much easier to forget your mortality when you're not confronted with fragile people. And although I don't think that we need necessarily dwell upon our mortality, that probably isn't what some would call good mental health, I also think that trying to remember every once in a while that we are fragile mortal human beings and we are very much alike, even during our mortal times, but certainly in the hereafter we would be, that by having different people in our midst, people who we are unsure about, people who are strange to us, people who are not as capable, we do remember our mortality, and possibly we won't do so many foolish things with our lives. We might not be as prideful. We might not be as acquisitive. We might not want to grab everything for ourselves forever, if we remember that our forevers are relatively short times. So I think it would be good for me, my family, my children, my children's children, to have better assurance that they will have opportunity to live and learn to get along with and to learn to understand and to learn from people who are widely different.
How true. And children take to that so much more easily than adults, don't they?
Well, you know, there's very little in the literature on development that ever gets nailed down so we are certain about, for example, how children learn or what they learn and how is the best way to learn. Seems every time we prove something concerning a method in school or a curriculum, there's someone else who disproves it or finds such false with the method or the curriculum that another one replaces it. But the one thing that seems to consistently come out in studies of prejudice is that children have much less of it than adults. And children who have had opportunities to interact with the blind or the deaf or the otherwise handicapped seem to be less fearful and thus less prejudiced about continuing such kinds of interactions in their later lives. And there's so much fear about it. For years, I used to observe outside of my window on South Cross Avenue the individuals who would come to our campus to learn mobility. There has been and there still is a program at Upstate Medical Center on parapetology, mobility for the blind. And these people are college students who would come to our campus and get training on independence, mobility independence. And I'd watch these people come to a corner. And it might have been their first or second day on campus. And they were obviously blind. They had a cane. They looked confused. They didn't quite know where they were. And, of course, I knew that there was a trainer very nearby. And so the person could not get into difficulty, real difficulty. But the other pedestrians didn't know that. And I would watch to see if anyone would walk over to that blind person and ask if he needed help or assistance of some type. Now, I do understand that not all blind people need such help, certainly, and even I've heard now and again that they don't want such help. But again, the pedestrians don't know that either. And what always interested me was how few sighted people would come over to a blind person and offer help, or how few of us turn away when we see a cerebral palsy person walking down the street. And I wondered so many times, why do we turn away from people who are blind or people who are palsied or people who seem to be in distress, people who have fallen on the sidewalk and appear to be in desperate trouble and otherwise decent and kindly human beings or turn away or walk right past these people. I don't believe it's only because one doesn't want to get involved because one is fearful of a lawsuit or an entanglement, but I more believe that we are fearful of the handicapped and of difference. And I think the cause of that is very much connected with the absence of handicapped people from our lives. If you grow up in a community where everyone is of the same color, and if you go to a school where you never see a blind child or a palsy child or a retarded child, you learn not to have those people near you. You learn to stay away from those kinds of people. And not only are the blind and the deaf and the retarded hurt by that exclusion, we are too. We live our lives with certain fears that may never have occurred.
That's right, and because we haven't had this exposure, I think people aren't sure how to act or what to expect. How would you say, what would you tell the community? How might mentally retarded people be different, if at all? And how can people act toward the retarded to help break the ice, to become more comfortable as neighbors?
There were a few studies done in the late 50s and early 60s on the kinds of children that ordinary elementary and secondary teachers would teach. And these studies also included special education teachers. What was interesting about them is the ordinary teachers were fearful of most of these children, whether they were blind or deaf or disturbed or retarded. They would just as soon not have to teach any of those children in their classes. What was also interesting is that they had very little, if any, experience with such children. Well, surprisingly, possibly, the special education teachers responded to those surveys in exactly the same way. The teacher of the mentally retarded would respond, "Oh, yes, I'm very comfortable teaching the mentally retarded. They're not difficult to teach, but I just wouldn't know what to do if I had a deaf or blind child in my class. I'm sure the most difficult types of children to teach." But the teacher of the deaf said, "Oh, teaching a deaf child, that isn't terribly difficult if you know what you're doing," which is, of course, the key, and if you're familiar with such children, which is also the key. But the teacher of the deaf would say, "I don't know, wouldn't know what to do with a retarded child. I just wouldn't want such a child in my classroom." Well, the point is, with familiarity, we learn that the mentally retarded aren't different than we are, not in the fundamental ways. They respond to kindness the way we do. They respond to reinforcement the way we do. They respond to danger the way we would. They could be very good neighbors. They could be helpful. They could be interesting people. And so I would suggest to those communities that have fears, and I would say unreasonable fears, that is, fears without foundation, that they should make it their business to visit people who are mentally retarded, who are living in their own homes. And most mentally retarded people live in their own homes or visit group homes or other community types of residences for the mentally retarded, and volunteer in those places and get involved with those people, or as a neighbor, get to know those people. I think they're going to find that virtually all of their fears are unfounded, that the mentally retarded can make superb neighbors and can help and enrich a community. And those mentally retarded citizens would be good to have as neighbors.
That's right. Now, how, as Dean of Education, Dr. Blatt, are you finding that your students in education are enthusiastic about the challenges of what's called mainstreaming and receptive? Do you see differences in attitudes in generations of students toward this? After all, this places a new obligation on the part of that teacher.
Yes, sure. Well, this is my 31st year in teaching, and virtually all of it with or about the mentally retarded. When I first came into this field, the treatment that was most strongly recommended included segregated separate classes. We taught our students to design, develop, and teach in segregated special programs, oftentimes in segregated buildings. And if a child couldn't do well in a segregated special program, possibly that child might be a good candidate for a good institution. And so the ideology of the profession 30 years ago was in the promotion of segregation. Now, of course, we were sure then of our position in segregating, as we are sure today in our position on integration. My own doctoral dissertation and many, many studies subsequently done right across the country indicated during the mid-50s through late 60s that these segregated programs in the public schools didn't do these children any more good academically or vocationally than had these children been in the regular classes. Well, we didn't want to hear the evidence 30 years ago. We were certain that segregation was the treatment of choice. Now, today, we are just as certain, and I think we're wiser today, that integration should be the policy for not only the retarded, but all handicapped. But as a matter of fact, and this gets back to what I had said earlier, this is not an issue that is going to be decided on evidence. It's quite possible that mentally retarded children could learn to read just as well in the educable class as those children could learn to read in the second or third grade. What we do know now is that they don't learn to read any better in the special class, but it's possible they don't learn to read any worse in the special class. I think the question is, what do we want for our children and what do we want for our society? Do we want a significant portion of our children in school and a significant portion of our total society segregated out of it, living apart from ordinary life? Or do we want those people as part of our lives? Now, if the answer is the latter, that we want all of us together in one integrated, widely varying culture, then we must develop mainstream programs, irrespective of whether one reads a little bit better in one type of program or another. The issue is around the quality of one's life and interactions, not whether you read better in one setting or another.
I have a global question. As you look back over your distinguished years as an educator, what satisfies you most about the changes, perhaps, on the part of the public and professional towards persons who are retarded, and what discourages you?
Well, I think what satisfies me most is that the language we use to and about behalf of, in relation to, the mentally retarded has changed dramatically. And for me, that means that it's certain that policies and programs will similarly change. 30 years ago, we spoke about institutions as satisfactory places for the mentally retarded to live. Today, even those who run institutions, for the most part, don't claim that these are satisfactory places. Those who run institutions today claim that we need them a little while longer while we get the community programs in place. And I can't recall how many times in the last few years I have heard superintendents of institutions or state commissioners brag about the deinstitutionalization program they have. And so the mark of success of a state commissioner or an institutional superintendent is how many placements he's made in the community. Well, you know, the chancellor of Syracuse University doesn't brag how many students transferred from Syracuse to Yale or to Harvard or to wherever. We want the students to come to Syracuse to study with us. And if we have fewer students next year than this year, and we wanted those students to be here, we wouldn't feel that we're terribly successful that our students are being deinstitutionalized from Syracuse University. Well, what does that tell us? That tells us that there seems to be, at least verbally, agreement that the community is the best place for people. There seems to be agreement that deinstitutionalization is a proper policy, albeit not one that is proceeding with the speed we would wish it to show. There seems to be an agreement across the country. It's now law of the land that there will be zero reject in the schools. Every child will be afforded a free public education. 30 years ago, if a child wet his pants in the first grade, he could be excluded or exempted. Today, we no longer countenance that type of policy, even though, of course, there are, to this minute, children excluded or exempted from schools. But they are exceptions to the new policy rather than examples of the implanted policy. The language has changed remarkably. 30 years ago, the definition of mental retardation informed us that mental retardation is a constitutional condition of the central nervous system. It exists from birth or early age. Is incurable and irremediable. That is, this is a condition that has as its cause some brain deficiency or damage, and it's incurable. Well, the definition today does not eliminate the possibility of a cure, if you will. Mental retardation is today defined as a functional condition. At this moment, under these conditions, this individual has low psychometric capability, that is, low IQ, associated with some adaptive disorder. But if the person changes, if that person now becomes socially adjusted and is able to maintain him or herself in the community, that person need no longer be called mentally retarded. So the idea of modification of intelligence, the idea that intelligence is educable, it's a function of practice and training. These are all ideas that have been nurtured during the last decade or two, and indeed are now part of the language that professionals and parents and ordinary citizens use concerning discussion of the mentally retarded. We have such terms as normalization. Normalization is a concept that would not have been understood in relationship to mentally retarded people 30 years ago. The definition of mental retardation 30 years ago virtually prohibited the idea of normalization of these people. Now, what am I unhappy about? We still tell stories about the mentally retarded that hurt them and can kill them. You know, how we tell a story about someone determines how we think about them and how we deal with them. Oh, as an example, there's the story of the old woman who lives alone in a large house, and the story in the neighborhood is that she has $1 million hidden in her mattress. Everyone hears these stories. And so one day, three people break into the house and kill her and open up the mattress, and all they find is feathers. And then there's the story of the old couple who live alone in a large house, and the man dies, and the woman's children come from far away to assess the situation and take care of things. And they determine that the old woman is no longer capable of living alone, so they place her in a home. Now, in the first instance, those people who told that story about that woman were up to mischief. And indeed, mischief occurred. In the second instance, the story was probably not mischievously intended. Probably the children did want to help their mother. And yet, because both stories were untrue about those individuals, there was great mischief. You can't tell an untrue story about somebody and without having that person harmed. Even when you tell a very positive story about the person, if it's untrue, they're not helped. If you say so-and-so is a great teacher and a great professor, and then you put so-and-so, who's really a poor teacher and a poor professor, in the spotlight on the basis of that untrue story, eventually there's going to be great disillusionment. Well, I think we're still telling very untrue stories about the mentally retarded. We're saying that the mentally retarded are dangerous at times. Well, has a mentally retarded person ever been dangerous? Of course. So has a professor been dangerous? There was truth to the story about the old woman. She did own a mattress. I mean, the lie was that there was no money in it. So you see, you could tell a story that has enough truth in it that causes so much problems. And that's what hurts me. That's what disconcerts me to this minute, that we continue to tell untrue stories about retarded people, that they are dangerous, or that they have loose morals, or they are not clean, or they're going to be a drain on the community, and on we go. And I say, someday we'll be telling true stories about those people, and then life is going to be as okay for them as it is for the rest of us.
Do you think the momentum to deinstitutionalize could be set back politically or philosophically, or do you think there are safeguards to keep the momentum going? Because there have been neighbors upset. They call their politicians. There's pressure. Not everyone is courageous politically to take stands. Do you think the program will take root and really keep moving?
Well, on the one hand, because the language is more and more becoming the language of integration, of normalization, of inclusion, of human rights, of dignity for these people, it's going to take an awful lot to reverse the positive trend I see. On the other hand, when you realize that many states have made enormous investments in the real estate and buildings the state owns to house these people, and many states have financed those institutions by issuing bonds that people own. And in those instances, the only way the people will be paid off for the bonds they own on these institutions is for retarded individuals to be in those institutions, and for essentially Title 19 payments coming into the state from the federal government, which is at least in the state I'm most familiar with, goes directly to pay off the bondholders. There would be grave difficulties in a massive deinstitutionalization program because there would be in some states hundreds of millions of dollars that the state would have to come up with to pay off bondholders or default. Either way, the state is in a very precarious position. So you have that. You have the real estate. What do we do with it? And I'm sick and tired of hearing such plans that would include making these institutions into community colleges or motels. They weren't built for those purposes. They don't seem to be suitable for those purposes. It might very well be that the state is going to take some licking on that real estate. But certainly, we ought to be wise enough not to have any more institutional building, and we ought to have a moratorium on all new institutional construction, because it's very expensive, or maybe $100,000 a bed these days to build a new institution, and not needed. You also have the unions. Thousands and thousands of employees in the state's mental retardation system. Most states, at least in the Northeast, unionized. What happens to these people now? You and I, Sue, are convinced that there are good and important jobs for these people to do in the community. Well, the workers themselves aren't always as sanguine about those opportunities. And besides, they like it fine where they are now. So you've got a serious union problem that must be solved. There's also the architects who design these institutions. In most states, maybe all states at one time or another, the state is the largest purchaser of new buildings, new large buildings, much larger than the big corporations. States building hospitals, office buildings, institutions, you name it, roads, state bills, which is proper. In many states, departments of mental health, mental hygiene, mental retardation are among the biggest purchases of new buildings. So you have that. You have the suppliers. You have people who supply not a case of toilet paper, but a carload of toilet paper, because you're talking about large, large facilities. And they've enjoyed contracts with the state for many, many years. When you decentralize into group homes or to people's own homes, they go to the local supermarket to buy their tuna fish. They don't get the tuna fish delivered to them by the carload or even by the case. They buy, at least if they're like us, they buy a can or two at a time. So you've got, really, a big industry around this monolith we call the mental retardation system. And it's big business. So that's going to be, in my view, a roadblock to deinstitutionalization. Then, of course, you have the consumers. The parents have, thinking they received the best advice from pediatrician, from family physician, from wise uncle in the family, from whomever, from mental retardation experts. You should place baby in the institution, or your young son or daughter, or your brother or whatever. And they've learned to live without those people at home. Some of their family members have been in institutions for 10 or 20 or 30 years. My heavens, we send our children away to college. In 4 years, the family is different. And the son or daughter comes home for Christmas vacation, there's hardly a bed for him to sleep in, because other people are making now other use of that room. So when you send your child off to school, the family changes. My heavens, when you send somebody away to an institution for years, that family is going to change. They will not as readily be able to accept return of the individual. And of course, while we're all speaking the language of normalization, there are precious few community programs, and so the community doesn't have yet in place the proper conversion programs. And until they do get them into place, we have problems. We have a scandal here and there, an accident here and there, loudmouth people saying the wrong thing, or well-intentioned people saying the wrong thing. And so we're far from home on this issue, but I keep coming back to the fact, the plain fact, that the language has changed, therefore the thinking has changed. We are no longer the same society we had been, and it seems to me, at least, that we've come a far way from Christmas in purgatory.
Yeah, I could go on forever picking your brains. I really love to talk to you. That covers everything that they need, and they'll get some marvelous material out of that.
Enjoy doing it.
Thank you very much. Very much.